I do think our healthcare system and big pharma are even guiltier than, say, the supply chain within the food industry. Because if you had told me 40 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever, that I will feel better and I will not be needing to go to the doctors for the kind of things that people go to the doctor for if I ate the way I eat today. If you had told me that then, but who's going to tell you that? Your doctor's not, just like I told you earlier in this discussion, that the doctors were telling me, oh, you're getting older, this is all normal. You know, your cholesterol's high, you're getting older, here, we'll give you drugs. I mean, that's bad.
This is Evolve CPG's Brands for a Better World podcast, featuring purpose-driven leaders who not only believe in better, but actively pursue it. That's better products, better brands, and better leadership for a better world. Thanks to you, our listeners, this podcast is now ranked in the top 10% of all podcasts globally. Let's not stop there, though. You can help us reach more people by taking a moment to leave us a rating or review, which is critical for podcast algorithms, and by sharing your favorite episodes with your network. The more people we reach, the more good we can bring about in this world. If you work in the industry, you can also join our online community where we're going further, faster, together at community.evolvecpg.com. I'm your host, Gage Mitchell, founder and creative director of Modern Species, a sustainable brand design agency helping better brands grow and scale their impact. On this episode, we're speaking with Bobby Giudicelli, co-founder of Read the Ingredients, about overcoming her toxic relationship with food, why she lives a plant-based whole food lifestyle, how the food industry is broken, why as a serial entrepreneur, this is her most challenging business yet, and more.
Hi, I'm Bobby Giudicelli. I am a co-founder of Read the Ingredients and the author of Freedom from a Toxic Relationship with Food. Read the Ingredients is a brand where we create some of the cleanest, absolute healthiest, vegan and gluten-free meal alternative packaged food available anywhere on the market.
Well, I'm excited to be chatting with you, Bobby, and I have tried your products and love them too, so I'm excited to get the word out to other people. I'm always, like you, I think, looking for healthier food that you can take on the go that is substantial but also kind of meets your dietary requirements. So excited to share those products with our community. With that said, before we dive into Read the Ingredients, I want to talk a little bit about your book. So you kind of outline your health journey in your book, Freedom from a Toxic Relationship with Food. And I imagine even just that title alone, a lot of our listeners will relate to. But I'm curious if you could describe kind of what you mean by a toxic relationship with food for those listeners who haven't read your book yet.
Sure. Toxic is an extreme word, and it did apply to me, and I think it does apply to a lot of people. But I would say that a toxic relationship of any kind, whether it's with food or with people or with whatever, is really when you are out of control or it seems like there's very little positive about that particular relationship. And for sure, that was my experience for a good portion of my life where food was the enemy. I mean, even food that I so-called liked, that I thought I liked. Let's take chocolate, for example, because chocolate was a food that I would eat obsessively. I would use food for all the wrong reasons. But chocolate, for example, while I said I love chocolate, the truth is I would eat it. I would have noise in my head. I would be negotiating with myself of how am I making it okay to eat that chocolate when I know it's not going to make me feel good, it's not going to make me happy with how it affects my body, my mind, my mood, everything. And yet, so I would have all this noise in my head while I'm eating, and it wasn't just chocolate. It was pretty much every single food I ate, unless it was lettuce. And that was my relationship with food, because it started from, and I think this is true maybe more for women than men, but I think men as well. It started with an obsession that our culture has, the women in our culture especially, have to be thin. And we grow up learning that thin is attractive, but thin is also, we learn and believe that thin is healthy. So I was driven to be, in every other way, I lived a pretty healthy life. I was very active. I've always been athletic. I was healthy. And I maintained a weight that nobody would know the struggles that I had with food. And so it became a very toxic relationship. I was out of control around food. I was afraid of food. It made me anxious. You know, I'm pretty much a calm person. I mean, I don't get anxiety. I'm a doer. If there's a problem, if there's something that stresses me, I go look for the solution. But food and being around food for most of my life was anxiety provoking, and I couldn't find, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't find a solution.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense on multiple levels. First off, when you have any sensitivities to food and those foods make you feel like crap, that's enough to give somebody anxiety because your mouth maybe wants it, but your body doesn't. So that's a mental gymnastics that you have to jump through there. But then, of course, with mother culture whispering in our ear, these unrealistic ideals around body types or whatever that we're supposed to be conforming to, even if that's not our body type or suits what we need out of life. And then also just the myth, like you were saying, that thin equals healthy. Like, I think that's not always the case. I know bigger people who are probably 10 times healthier than I am. And I know thinner people who are probably having extreme health problems because of diet, right? So the weight isn't necessarily translate to health. But when we get those ideas stuck in our head, it's enough to make us go a little bit crazy and make food, which can be a really enjoyable thing, makes it kind of torture instead, right?
You know, the irony is, Gage, that food should be and is an incredibly enjoyable thing. We are hardwired, we are put on this planet to want to eat, to enjoy food, for food to serve us and serve us well, a lot better than what we use medicine and other things for. Food truly should be our medicine. Food should be the thing that not only sustains us, but keeps us healthy and is enjoyable. And I can tell you, I never, 15 years ago, if we were having this conversation, I can tell you I would have been certain that that would never have been the case for me. And today I am here to tell you there is so much joy in food for me now. And I do have the relationship with food that I never dreamed I would have. I'm going to go out on a limb here and tell you, while this is going to open Pandora's box, I'm going to tell you it not only changed my relationship with food, but changing that part of my lifestyle changed my relationship with everything, with myself, with other people, with my work, with what's important to me. My whole world changed, because if you're eating poorly, nothing in your body really works. If you're eating healthy, everything, your mood, your outlook on life, your how you feel, your energy level, everything changes. And I'm in my late 60s, and I feel like I'm better than I did when I was 40. I truly do.
Yeah. I mean, I believe it. When your body's, the times that I have something that doesn't agree with me, I feel like crap. My brain's not working as well. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. I'm in pain. You know, like you just can't go through life feeling your best or doing your best work or anything like that when you've got problems within your body, right? And I think it's similar to other health aspects as well. Like for me, my bigger issue early in life was sleep. I was always underslept. I was always tired. I was always falling asleep at work, on buses, like while standing waiting for my girlfriend to try on clothes at the mall, like whatever. It was just a problem for me, and I was always just kind of groggy. But I read a book called The Promise of Sleep by Dr. Dement that was all broke down sleep debt and how much sleep we need and the quality of sleep and different sleep problems. And after reading that, I did some studies on myself, like without going to a doctor, but just kind of like tried some things and found the right balance of sleep or the type of sleep or how much sleep I need. And once I did that, like everything changed. I could all of a sudden read books without falling asleep. I can drive. I even took a road trip that was like a 24-hour road trip. And, you know, some of my times behind the wheel could have been like 10 hours plus, and I would never got tired enough to like need to pull over. So like, I think sleep, food, mental health, like there's all these buckets that if you've got a problem with one of those areas, it's going to bleed out into everything else in your life.
And absolutely.
First off, identifying which of those problems you have is important, but then going through the process to solve it will help everything.
Exactly. Right. And you never have just one of those problems. I mean, if when you're not eating well, you're not going to sleep well. And if you're not sleeping well, it does affect your appetite and, you know, what you crave and trying your body telling you you need sugar. When, you know, when we go to sugar and the way we as in the standard American diet eat, we go to sugar, we go to refined sugar. And the truth is, go to fruit, go to something that's healthy for you and that's going to work for you, that's going to help boost your sugar level without, you know, eating processed food. I mean, it's the processed food that kills us. And it's the processed food that kills every aspect of how our bodies work, whether it be sleep, our immune system, our energy level, our moods, is all damaged and impacted by, you know, what we eat and impacted badly. If you remember when you got our Read the Ingredients Superloaf package, I don't have one here, unfortunately, but when you got those, if you recall, the tagline on the flap of the box says, food that won't slowly kill you. I am a firm believer that what you eat is either doing you good or doing you damage, and there's kind of no in between. So if you're eating highly processed food, it is actually taking away from your health. If you are eating whole food, plant-based, it is actually adding to your health and your, you know, the status of your health. And it's really sad because big food companies go out of their way to convince you that their products are healthy, even though they have additives, things in there that you can't pronounce, sugar, added salt, you know, preservatives of all kinds. It's been sprayed with insecticides, the main ingredients. It's, you know, we are killing ourselves with the way we eat here in America. And then, you know, Big Pharma comes in and supports it because guess what? They love us relying on medication to stay alive and to be what they call healthy. And at the end of the day, that's not the answer either. So, but it takes, you know, it's very, very frustrating. I'm going to tell you, getting into this industry was crazy frustrating when I learned what I learned about why people believe that if they get the whole wheat crackers, they're eating something healthy. Never mind all the other crap that's in there. That whole wheat box of, I won't use names, but that whole wheat box of crackers, it's not good for you. Yes, it will put a little extra fiber in you, but that fiber is destroyed and your microbiome's ability to use the fiber is destroyed because all the other things completely upset your system and your microbiome.
Yeah, totally. I think processed food for sure, like you're saying, all the bad stuff they put in there that we shouldn't probably be putting in our body in the first place, disguised as being healthy because it has one healthy thing like, oh, lower sugar or more fiber or something like that. So we see that call out and we think, great, this must be health food. But it's really they just tweaked one thing for marketing purposes because they know that's hot right now. And then they can have one better ingredient in there and then everything else is garbage. But that's why I like the name of your company.
Yeah, I'll even take it a step further. Like, let's take gluten-free, for example. So gluten-free became popular. Okay, suddenly there's a whole lot of press about gluten and yet they always tie it back to, and now we're coming full circle about talking about the toxic relationship with food, but they always tie it back to, and it will help you lose weight. Fiber will help you lose weight. Take the gluten out. And, well, do you know what they put in when they don't have gluten? Let's start with whatever stabilizer-like or emulsifier-like xanthan gum. I don't even want to begin to tell you what xanthan gum is. But if you see it on the package, don't eat it. If you don't know what it is, don't eat it. If it's not something you could buy in a whole form and eat, don't eat it. You know, and so the big food companies have spent a lot of money marketing to convince people you'll lose weight, you'll be healthier, you know, all of these things will be good for you when at the end of the day, it's completely opposite. And, you know, regulations are, I mean, it just, it goes so deep. We don't have time today to go into why it's politically impossible for that system to change and for us small guys trying to do the right thing and create the best products. It's very challenging.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of why I host this podcast is to raise awareness around brands that are out there trying to do the right things and have better ingredients and more sustainable agriculture and, you know, give back to communities and so on and so forth. Partly because I want to help those brands grow, but also just to help people who maybe aren't steeped in this industry understand some of the challenges and some of the things they should be looking out for. Which gets me back to what part of why I like the name of your company, Read the Ingredients, is because that's so important in a thing that most people don't understand. Again, they pay attention to the callouts on the front of the box, the, you know, grams of fiber or the low sugar or something like that. But then when you flip it around and read the ingredients, if the reason it has no sugar is because they filled it with a bunch of sweet tasting chemicals, well, that's not necessarily healthy then, because those chemicals might be worse for you than the sugar was in the first place, right? But these brands are just putting low sugar on there because they know that's what you want, because you've read these articles about how sugar is bad for you, or you're trying to lose weight or something like that. But again, if you go and read the ingredients and it's not things you recognize, then that means they probably put a bunch of stuff in there or hid a bunch of stuff in there to try to make it taste good or hold it together or preserve it or something like that, that are things that maybe you shouldn't be eating. So just the name of your business alone, I think, will help people change their mindset around food. Don't just believe the claims on the front of the box. Flip it around and read the ingredients.
Yeah, absolutely. And we want you to turn the box over and read our ingredients. There is nothing but whole food. The only thing processed in there is the hemp protein. And the only processing it's done is it takes out the cleanest, healthiest part of an organic hemp plant, which is the seed and the heart of the seed, and they mash it into a powder. There you have hemp powder. Other than that, everything we use is a whole food ingredient. It's real apples, it's real bananas, it's, you know, real oats. It's, I mean, it's the cleanest product and, you know, the only thing on the market in a package. So the reason I created them is after I was on this journey and I started eating super clean, I started needing to travel quite a bit from where I fly from to where I was going. I was all day running through airports. There is nothing in an airport that I can grab and eat, like literally nothing. You're even hard pressed to find a restaurant that has a salad that isn't pre-made with, you know, processed cheeses and things like that. So, you know, I really, really scanned the market for something that is convenient. And by the way, we made them to be a full meal. So if you eat the 300 to 375 calories, depending which flavor, one of our super loaves, you're going to be satisfied for a very long time because you don't have empty calories of sugar. You don't have, I mean, these are all calories that are adding nutrition and will satisfy you and will give you the energy you need. You're not burning through sugar real fast or anything else that's adding empty calories.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've had similar issues with traveling. I feel like every time I travel, I come home feeling like crap afterwards. You know, partly maybe the schedule, but partly maybe dehydration because I don't want to have to get up all the time while on the road or on an airplane or something like that. But then also, like you said, the food, like whether you're eating crap that you grab and go in an airport or restaurant food or fast food or whatever you're eating, it's almost always, probably 99.9% of the time, going to be less healthy than the food I'm eating at home. So I end up coming home exhausted, tired, bloated, like feeling
awful.
Wiped out. Yeah.
Right. I mean, travel is hard enough as it is. I mean, the airport is not your friend. TSA is not your friend. The airlines are not trying to make you more comfortable. So, I mean, if you have to travel and go through that to not take care of yourself physically. And by the way, just a little suggestion, drink a lot on the plane and get up as many times, because guess what? That exercise helps you too. So get up as many times as you need to, and, you know, to go to the bathroom or whatever. And like I do, I go out of my way. I always take an aisle seat so I'm not running over somebody else. But like I look forward to walking up and down the aisle several times during a flight, because sitting like that will kill you. I mean, you know, that's also terrible. So yeah, travel's not fun, but at least I know now I take super loaves with me. I take my water jug with me, and, you know, I feel I don't get destroyed traveling like I used to. So yeah, it really does help.
Great. Yeah, I'm looking to try to have better travel habits. So bring in some super loaves and some water bottles and stuff I think I need to do. But also just I've been planning to bring some additional kind of fiber because when you're eating out and stuff, you don't know if you're getting enough fiber. Like just little things like that that I'm learning about myself as I get older or when I travel, I need to pay a little bit more attention to some of those things. So I know that your journey down this kind of healthier eating path, you kind of outlined some of it in more detail in your book, but it started when your sister was battling with cancer, which I think a lot of people wait until something bad happens to them, like they have a heart attack or they get told by their doctor that you're at a health risk because your cholesterol is too high or they themselves get cancer or something like that before they change their life. Because like I think I heard a quote, I forget where this quote came from, but said something to the effect of when your pain becomes greater than the amount of effort it's going to take to change, that's when you finally make a change. It's you have to wait until there's that much pain to force you into it. I wish more people didn't wait until they had their own health problems. So could you talk a little bit about how your sister's health challenge kind of inspired you to go down this path?
Sure. And it wasn't that simple. It was more like a trifecta. There were three things all happening at the same time. So it wasn't just that, but I consider myself very lucky that those three things all did happen at the same time. There's something else that remind me to come back to. I want to talk about change, you know, people making a big change. So my sister was diagnosed with cancer. I was pretty sure she was about 3 years in. I mean, she was in remission and then was re-diagnosed, and I kind of knew it was the end. I was flying across country because she lived on the East Coast. I'm on the West Coast. I was flying across country. I was really her primary caretaker. She was not married and no kids. I was a witness to this horrendous, horrendous disease. And I mean, it got her, every part of her body. I mean, it was really awful to watch. That was happening at the same time that my father was aging. Our family had all been very active, so we were all convinced that we're all very healthy, you know, skiing, and I was a tennis player and, you know, whatever. I mean, we were all very active. None of us really, in retrospect, I now know none of us ate very well. But my father, who really skied up until he was 80, suddenly 80 was, things went south for him. It started with physical challenges and then dementia set in, and dementia progressed rapidly. So I was experiencing that. Also didn't live near him, mostly saw him when he would come visit my sister or, you know, whatever. And I was in shock that this man who was always so healthy is now like a mess. And so that was happening. And at the same time, I finally had to acknowledge, like, when I would come home from her place, I was so exhausted. I literally couldn't get out of bed. And I've never been somebody who fatigue would stop me. I mean, I know I experienced a lot of fatigue. I can remember mentioning it to doctors in my 40s. I was playing a lot of tennis, and I would say at the end of playing tennis, I am exhausted. And that, oh, you're getting older, was the answer. Relatively speaking, I was not very old, but the fatigue got extreme, absolutely extreme. So I could no longer deny. Once I had seen her through her crisis, she did pass away. And I was back on the West Coast, and I figured, oh, I'll start feeling better, getting my energy back. And I didn't. I mean, you know, I have horses on my property. I would walk out to the barn to feed them. I literally had to take a break getting back to my house. And I was like, oh my God, this is, you know, this is bad. I mean, it was such fatigue. I couldn't believe it. And I'm in the gym every single day. So this is not you fell out of shape. This is something really ridiculous. And so those three things together, knowing I didn't want my life to end. My father didn't die till he was in his early 90s. I don't want to live the last 10 years of my life like that. I don't want to die prematurely from cancer or any other heart disease or whatever. And I can't do anything. So it's time to fess up and acknowledge that I have, while I tried to convince myself I ate healthy, at the end of the day, I didn't. And I knew I didn't. And the only way I'm going to find out, since doctors are telling me, oh, you're just getting older, no, you're fine, the only way was to teach myself. And so I did. I rolled up my sleeves and I taught myself what nutrition is. And it took me, I would say the whole journey for me was a year and a half, but I outline it in the book because now I know and how I did it. If I were talking to me, the old me, I would have the whole process, the whole transition would have been probably 3 to 6 months. And I just figured out, eliminate these things one at a time. So now I want to talk about change. So I talk to people now who, you know, so relate, people who have read my book. I mean, people reach out to me after they read my book, people I don't know, because I, in the book, I really welcome them too, because I did write the book because I feel for anybody that has gone through the kind of relationship with food that I went through most of my life. And I mean, it's an awful, awful place to be. And so I've talked to a lot of people and, you know, their answer is always, oh, I can't give up whatever, fill in the blank. I can't give up cheese. I can't give up sugar. I can't give up chocolate, whatever it is. And, you know, what I really realize is it's the anticipation of the change or the anticipation of giving something up is much, much worse than actually doing it. And all of us who think weight is our problem, we give up things all the time. Every new diet is giving something up. But in our mind, we're temporarily giving it up until we lose that weight. And then we know we're going back to it. Or the people who say, well, I eat everything, but I eat in moderation. Well, no, you don't, or you wouldn't be looking like that or feeling like that. And people kid themselves because most human beings, change is very difficult. It's very difficult. But again, it's the anticipation of change. I happen to consider myself very, very fortunate because I'm somebody who has embraced change my whole life. I really believe that my life is on an upward trajectory of not being very good when I was young and knowing that change always made things better. And so I don't run from change. I really don't. I just have to believe that's the right change for me to make. And that's in the food department. That's what took me so darn long. And I was one of those people going, oh, I couldn't live without chocolate. I couldn't live without pizza. I couldn't live without, you know, whatever the food is. But you can. And my biggest point that I really want to emphasize and that I wanted to get across in the book is that you do stop craving. You stop being addicted to the food. The emotional challenge, or what are you going to substitute for that? You know, you had a frustrating day, food's been your drug. What are you going to substitute for those, the salty, whatever, the potato chips or the chocolate? And I address that in the book. But the actual craving of chocolate, like I would only eat milk chocolate when I was back in the day. And I couldn't eat milk chocolate now if you paid me. I do eat chocolate. I eat a very dark chocolate with very little sugar in it. It has no milk in it. It's, you know, it's vegan because I'm vegan. I actually make my own chocolate bark with all kinds of nuts and seeds in it. And I love it. And I can eat a small piece of that and I'm fine. And in the old days, it would be 6 chocolate bars of milk chocolate because you do create an addiction. And because you're telling yourself, well, I'll have this now, then it won't be in the house and I won't have to eat it tomorrow and I'll start dieting tomorrow or I won't eat for the next 3 days or whatever it is. I mean, that's crazy. I listen to this now and I know that voice was in my head before, but like I sound like a crazy person when I say it out loud. And yet that's how many, many, many of us live. I promise you, I wasn't the only one who is crazy or was crazy around food like that. And you don't believe it's, you know, it's an addiction. And the large food companies make sure that they support the addiction, create the addiction, and that you're going to come back and buy more. You can't eat just one. We're going to make sure you can't eat just one. You're going to eat 6 bags. And then you're going to come back and buy more for the next time. Yeah. It's nuts. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I feel like a lot of food's actually designed that way. Same thing with cigarettes. They were designed to be addictive, right? So a lot of food is the same way. Like the amount of sugar we put in things or different flavorings or other chemicals or or taste profiles that make you just keep wanting to eat. You just don't have the stop button with some of those foods, right? But I think to your point, when you're eating healthier foods, your body kind of recognizes, oh yeah, that was great. Thanks for the treat. Now I'm done. Another thing I want to point out is you're totally right. I think your body adjusts, your tastes change, right?
When
you shift to eating something better, all of a sudden that stuff that you used to eat tastes like garbage and you're wondering how anyone else eats any of that stuff. It's amazing.
I mean, it's so bad. Like if I go to a restaurant and it's not super clean, or God forbid they put it in a fryer or something like that, oh, it tastes awful. It feels awful. It's awful. Your taste buds completely wake up when you stop feeding it, you know, all the stuff that deadens your taste buds. Sugar deadens your taste buds. I used to put 4 packs of Equal in a cup of coffee. I'd have a cup of coffee every morning. It would have 4 packs of Equal and milk, which, by the way, milk has sugar in it. It would have to have all that in it. And I would taste my husband's coffee, which is black. And I go, I don't know how you can drink that. And he'd say, I don't know how you can drink that. Now I drink black coffee, or I make my own non-dairy milk that is just water and the nuts, or water and the oat. And I put a little of that. I love my coffee in the morning, especially with a super loaf. But, you know, but it's not like I can taste it. So this is shocking to me. I've always, you know, thought broccoli was fine. But now I love the taste of broccoli. You know, before it was good, or I'd put cheese on it or butter on it or, you know, whatever. And now I love broccoli. Like, what's happened here, right? I mean, it's such a reward. And that's the message that I hope somebody receives that will counterbalance how hard the change is, or what you think you're giving up is. No, you're not giving up anything. You're rewarding yourself, or you're giving yourself this gift where I look forward to that meal. I look forward to, like, I have a way, I used to not like tofu. And in a matter of fact, in the book, it says I don't eat tofu. So that was not a protein source for me. Well, one day I realized that all the tofu I've ever tasted was fried, because it was in some restaurant and it was fried. I've never been a huge fan of fried food. And then, so one day I bought tofu and I made it like with this marinade stuff. That's all good stuff. And it was like, holy cow, I am so in love with this stuff. And I started experimenting with tofu in all kinds of different ways. And it's like, now I love that. I mean, that is like a great food. And I feel like I've gotten a gift. You know, I have given myself this gift where I love to experiment and I taste everything. I really taste it. And life has changed. Life has changed.
Yeah. That reminds me of one of our past guests, Dennis Weaver, who's one of my collaborators in the Organic Marketing Association. His company is literally called Change Your Food, Change Your Life, because of exactly all the things you're talking about. Like, once he discovered the joy of organic good food and how much better he felt after eating it, and how much better often it tastes because it's, you know, hopefully as long as it's real organic and fresh and so on and so forth, it's going to be so much more delicious than processed or picked too early or shipped across the country, or, you know, whatever kind of garbage food that you're used to eating. And it'll just kind of change your life. And then the other thing was, I remembered the quote a little bit better, the one about change. And it was that once your pain becomes greater than the fear of change, that's when you'll finally change. And I think that kind of touches on your point of the anticipation of giving things up is harder than the actual act of doing it. So it's all about getting past that initial fear, making the change. And then, like you outline in the book, and you just said too, during that transition process where you're getting your body to adjust from the addictions of sugar and meat and other things, you just need to give yourself proper kind of replacements for those behaviors and use cases. So you still kind of are putting something in your body when you get these cravings, but you're putting something better in your body. And I would also argue that a lot of people go to the fridge or go to the cupboard to grab some food, not out of hunger often, but just out of boredom or anxiety or depression. You know, it's something else driving you to eat food. And I think you outlined that in the book too, is asking yourself, am I actually hungry right now? Or is there some other reason I'm standing in front of the fridge? Because we so often just put a ton of food or beverage or whatever in our mouth when we're not even hungry. And then we feel even worse afterwards, right? We feel bloated, we're overfull, we're burping up some food or whatever, and it's because we weren't actually hungry. We were just bored, and maybe there's something else you can do when you're bored.
Well, what's really cool is if you really are committed to eating only healthy food and you start enjoying the taste of it, guess what? You can still use it as an emotional crutch sometimes. Your drive to use it the way we used to use it with unhealthy food will be less strong, but you're not doing yourself any damage. You know, so I ate a few extra nuts one day, you know, because I'm just like, I'm frustrated. Whatever. Okay, I eat the nuts, I move on, you know, and no part of my mood, my body, my energy are impacted in any way whatsoever. And it gives you a little bit reminder of, I'm not really hungry, I'm avoiding something. What is it? Like, it's easier to say that after you've tried eating and say that's not solving the problem. The problem with eating bad food for those reasons is that you numb yourself. It's like drinking. You do numb yourself. And once you're numb, you can't address the real problem. You can't even explore the real problem. And, you know, now that I brought up about drinking and the similarities to an alcoholic, you know, my biggest fear used to be, I will never get over this. I wish I was an alcoholic instead or a drug addict instead, because you can eliminate those from your life. You can eliminate food from your life. Well, that now I'm on the other side of it. I go, that's the good news. You know, that used to be the bad news, but now that's the good news. Cause yeah, I get to eat as much as I want to eat foods that I love, because those all have changed. And I do eat more now than I ever ate before. And I also weigh less than I used to weigh. You know, I was never somebody that you would look at and go, oh my God, she needs to lose weight. But the weight came off. And, you know, my weight doesn't change. Like, from day to day to day, I guarantee you I'm within 2 pounds. And those 2 pounds have been that way for 7 years now. I go on vacation. I eat much more when I'm on vacation, but I don't stray from what I know I'm going to feel good eating. And I always take super loaves with me. But I don't usually, where we go on vacation, I don't usually have to resort to that. But yeah, it doesn't change because your body is taking in what it needs.
That's great. So, I mean, you've talked a lot about how your life changed by switching to a plant-based whole food diet. But with your products, your super loaves, somebody doesn't have to be 100% following that same whole food plant-based regime to get benefits from Superloaf, because like you said, it's just healthy, nutritious, tasty, you know, convenient food. But I'm curious, have you been hearing feedback from customers or your brand community that just by learning about your company and starting to read the ingredients and eating super loaves and whatever else, has that started inspiring them to go deeper into their health and help them change their lives too?
I can't say nobody, but here's our challenge. We have a lot of challenges. One is that we're a premium product. We use expensive ingredients, mostly organic. The ingredients that we use are not, you know, it's not an inexpensive product. So we've had customers who have, you know, tried it, said it's good, but usually it's somebody who hasn't had the experience to really reduce their desire for sweet. And so they go, these aren't, you know, they expect sweet because every other product, like we pretty much market it mostly as a full breakfast food. Well, I challenge anybody to find a full breakfast food in the store in a package that doesn't have sugar in it. And so while they think they're eating that whole grain cereal, the truth is they're consuming a lot of sugar. It's still very sweet, or people are putting more sweet on it, or that whole grain waffle they're putting syrup on or whatever. So a lot of people, their taste buds are still pretty deadened. So we go, well, it doesn't taste that good. I'm not going to spend that much money on that. So we've had that challenge. And so they think they're eating healthy, but the truth is this doesn't, their palate is not getting it because they're not really, they haven't given their body a chance to adjust to that. So that's one of our challenges. The cost is a challenge. And honestly, the people who thrive, who are subscribers, who convert to subscription as soon as they try our product and are eating it regularly, those are people that are eating super clean already. We have a huge nut to crack by getting, you know, spending most of our marketing dollars on educating the consumer. And basically, our educating the consumer consists of, hey, if you eat like crap, you're not going to like our products. Please don't try them. Because in the beginning, we offered that such a discount price, we were losing money. And guess what? We were getting bad reviews because people are going, oh, you know, that's the person that would rather go to Costco and buy a muffin. And, you know, that's not what our product is. So, you know, we decided we're not going to discount it and try and attract these not so smart marketing agencies. We spent a lot of money on a couple marketing agencies that just couldn't get around the idea that we're not a bar. We're not a bar. In so many ways, we're not a bar. And, but no, they go, but we can get the most eyes on your product if we, you know, use the bar customer. Well, the bar customer is expected to be sweet and mushy and just a snack and cheap and, yeah. And so that's who was buying and trying and going, yeah, no, I don't like this. And when we did finally get a little more sophisticated in how we market, we were finding some, not enough, and it is a niche product, but we were finding some of our target market who converts easily to a subscription and says, you know, yeah, this is good. I can't find anything like it. I'm taking it on my bike ride. I'm taking it to where I go, or I'm eating it, serving it for breakfast, you know, every day. I have eaten one for breakfast every single day and as necessary when I travel for breakfast or when I'm at someplace, you know, else for since I created the recipes, I think 7 years ago. I wouldn't start my day any other way. And it's hours before I'm hungry again. And my morning could include 3 hours of pickleball, which I play pretty aggressively. And it still holds me through that. So
yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and the price, it's interesting that you describe it that way. That if, of course, if somebody's comparing it to a $2 bar at the convenience store or something like that versus a super loaf, of course, they're going to be like, wow, this is expensive and not sugary enough or whatever else. But the way I was picturing it is comparing it to like a sandwich or a burrito or a pizza or a burger or something like that at an airport or something like that. And if I'm bringing a super loaf and that saves me the $12 from ordering a burger or getting a sandwich or a wrap or something like that at the airport, then the, I can't remember the price per piece, but let's say like $6 or something like that, that a super loaf costs is actually cheap. It's saving me money and I'll feel better after eating it. But to your point, I get that some people are so used to eating that less healthy food that they're craving that oil, that grease, that salt, that sugar, right? So it's a harder transition to just go cold turkey if this is the only healthy food they're integrating in their diet, but they're used to crappy food otherwise, then it's going to be a hard transition. So that makes sense that I guess your core user is somebody who's already healthy, but it also makes me wonder if there's future product development opportunities for you to create something that's a little bit more of a transition product. But that always comes down to, I think, entrepreneurs, especially when you're mission driven or whatever, to say like, well, do I make something that like has a little bit more sugar in it just so it can like be a transition to our main product? Or is there some other kind of format that you can make like fruit leathers or something that's whole fruit or whole food that is still really sweet but transitions them over time? But I could also see the value in just saying, you know what, that's not what we're about. We're just going to provide meal options for people who are already on this journey instead of trying to convert people.
Yeah, that's honestly, I'd sooner go out of business than have to compromise. If it's not a product I would eat, I'm not going to put it on the market. You know, just no way. I'm not going to put it on the market. So I would rather, you know, I have to tell you, my whole life has really been, let's see where this goes. You know, I follow my passion. I have followed my passion my entire career. I consider myself a serial entrepreneur. I've had very successful businesses for a good part of my career. I had a medium-sized executive search firm, and I would advise people on their careers all the time and ask them, what are your career goals and things like that. And what was interesting was most people, I believed, should have their goals. I was never somebody who had career goals. I followed where my passion was. And at this point, when I created Read the Ingredients, it was because my passion for that had completely, you know, consumed me because of the journey that I took to get healthy. And yeah, if it means for us to be successful and stay in business that I have to compromise on what I'm passionate about, I'm just not interested. I'm really not. I would sooner go explore and contribute in the areas where I'm passionate, because there's other ways I can share this. You know, writing the book was something else. It wasn't to support the company, although I would have loved to think that it, you know, supported Read the Ingredients, but it was because I'm passionate about sharing the idea of, hey, you guys, I struggled for 50 some years. You don't need to struggle. It was a gift that I gave myself that I did this and I want to share it. And yeah, so no, it's not in the cards that we're going to compromise so that we can get big market share. I'll see where the journey takes us.
Yeah. I mean, I think I like what you're saying, that it's focusing more on pursuing something you're passionate about than trying to pursue growth or quote unquote business success or something like that. And that reminds me of something I talk about often on the show, which is when you focus more on the problem you're trying to solve than the first solution you came up with, you find that you're more connected to your consumer, you better understand them because you're focused more on relieving their pain points or solving a problem for them. But you're also opening yourself up and your business up to lots of different solutions instead of that first one you came up with. So to your point, you'd rather shut the business down than compromise on your ideals. But by focusing on this problem of providing, you know, maybe based on what I know of you, it's like healthier, convenient food. There could be other healthy, convenient food products that could come to market. And maybe the super loaf is just not what people are looking for at the moment or something like that. But by solving that problem, it could be a book, it could be different products, it could be fast food restaurants, it could be, you could solve that problem in so many different ways. So keeping your mind open to other solutions, I think, is important.
Yeah, I learned so much about this food industry that I had no idea. I have to tell you, this is one of the first businesses that I started that I feel like the learning curve exposed many, many more challenges than I've ever faced before. I've always loved the beginning of every business that I started. I love the learning phase. I love the, you know, like just networking with people who you share ideas and you come up with the great solutions and huge successes. The food industry is not most of that. It's not. It's, you know, the more I would learn, the less excited I would get, the more frustrated I would get, the more I would, some days I actually use the term, this is a fool's game. There's too many moving pieces that support the big food businesses and our, you know, the supply chain that's dictated by politics. And it's very, very frustrating. And no, I would rather take my toys and go home than compromise and play their game. I really would. It's just, you know, integrity is one of my absolute most important values in my life. It absolutely is. And I don't feel there's integrity in the industry, in the big side, the old-fashioned side of the industry. There are a lot of brands like mine that are really trying to do the right thing. But I don't have respect for the industry.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's a big part of why I'm doing this podcast and online community, and why it's called Evolve CPG, because I feel like if we can more successfully evolve the consumer packaged goods industry, especially in the food space, that we can change the world, because the cards are stacked against brands that are trying to make the world a better place in this industry because of subsidies and lobbying and regulations and all sorts of other hoops and things that you have to jump through. And you're trying to put out a product that's more correctly priced for what food should cost, and you're fighting against a bunch of garbage stuff that could barely even be called food that's been subsidized by the government or whatever else along the way. So it's just not a fair fight at any point in the game. So not only is the food industry tough, but just CPG in general is tough because it's such a tight margins game. You have to try to get something to market that's affordable to people, like you were outlining before. But everything is stacked against you. Your ingredients are more expensive. Your supply chain's full of more integrity, so you're paying better prices. You're probably having to get certifications, which cost you money. You know, it just keeps going and going and going. It just makes it a difficult game. So that's part of why I try to feature folks like you on the show so others can learn from your experience, but also by building the kind of online community that we're putting together, it's hopefully creating a space where the Better for the World brands can connect with each other, help each other avoid costly mistakes, maybe collaborate on things to get costs down or whatever. Like whatever we can do to move further, faster together is the idea, because it is a super difficult industry. Not to say that business in general isn't difficult, but this is a particularly tough industry if you're trying to do things the right way instead of, like you said, filling your products with cheap garbage, which at that point, why even play the game?
It really is. I mean, I'll give you two examples. Number one, so we're certified. We were going for certification on organic and decided not to, but we did get certification for gluten-free and we got certification for non-GMO. And they price that based on the number of ingredients. So if a company like Kraft wants to go for an organic certification, they're paying exactly the same thing that I'm paying. I mean, really? Is that really fair? And the other example is distribution. So it became apparent to get into distribution, just to get into the retail store, every single item that moves off the shelf from a retail store for the next 5 years, I'm losing money on. Because the distribution agreements that you make with the distributors, the UNFIs and the Tahees and all of those people, is that you participate in promotions, you participate in discount pricing, and you participate in marketing. And at the end of the day, they're making 15 to 40% margin between the retailer and distributor, and our margins now are negative. How is that ever going to work? So the only answer is the companies that do make it, they go out and they get investors. Well, investors pre-COVID used to look at you when you would get to 5 million. Between 2 and 5 million, you could start talking to reasonable investors. Now, an investor doesn't even look at you till you show a path to 10 to 15 million and a path that's going to continue growing toward profit. And you don't make profit in this business until you are 10 to 15 million. You know, it's like I go, that's where the fool's game came up. I was like, yeah, no, I'm not going to sit at a poker table with professionals and I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. Yeah, so we've backed way down. We're doing some aggressive but smaller scale things that are not conventional. And we will either make it or we won't. I mean, I would love to think that we will. I would love to keep the customer base that we have and just go, okay, it's good not to become a huge company. Our time will come if we stay with it, you know, on a smaller scale. Okay, you know, I'm okay with that. I'm not okay with losing money every time somebody buys my product. I can't afford to do that anymore. I've invested a ton into this business. And, you know, I'd be an idiot to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear that story a lot with the smaller CPG brands that they end up choosing to pull out of all these distribution relationships because they're set up to fail, basically. Like, I should interview more distributors or retailers on this show to understand the challenge on their side better. But to be honest, like hearing it more from the brand sides, it almost sounds like extortion. Like you're saying they're making their margins and they still charge you for all sorts of promotions and free product and shelf placements and all this kind of stuff, where I just can't help but wonder, is that even necessary? Like, are there end margins so low that they have to do that to survive? Or are they just finding that they have the power since they have the relationship with the customer and therefore they're just finding ways to extract extra money from brands? I'm not sure. I haven't talked to enough distributors and retailers to know. But yeah, it just seems ridiculous. There's got to be better ways. Yeah. To do things.
I think what they would tell you is that, you know, because they can show you on paper dollars and cents that they have to charge that way because that's what it costs them. The truth is, at the end of the day, if they would recognize that a company like mine can't compete with, say, Kraft Foods, and that they can make their profit on Kraft Foods with it costing Kraft Foods less money, by the way, and then subsidize some of the smaller brands to help us get healthier food out there, But they're not going to do it because, you know, they run a business to get as profitable as they can get. So they're not going to do anything that offends Kraft Foods, just to use them as an example. And, you know, they're not going to give us a special deal because Kraft Foods will be mad at them and they can't afford to lose Kraft Foods. So we're stuck. They would tell you that they don't have a choice. And at the end of the day, they do. But they're not thinking in terms of helping America get healthy or healthier. They're thinking in terms of the bottom line, just like our utilities and a few other things that I know about. You know, it's all about the bottom line.
Healthcare and everything else. Yeah. Like it's, this is where the people who are anti-capitalism would just say, well, that's just capitalism. Like you can't avoid companies making these horrible decisions for their customers or for the world because they're justifying it to make a profit, right? That's the whole purpose of capitalism is you have to make more and more profit. Like you can't even just have a sustained profit with capitalism. You have to have increased profit every single quarter or else you're going to piss off your investors. And it's just a ridiculous model that's not only not sustainable, but very extractive in a downward spiral to the worst possible products, the worst health outcomes, crapping on your supply chain by underpaying people or using slave labor. It's just, it's this downward spiral that's just not going to work. So I think hopefully we can, through this podcast and all the efforts of people like you, we can try to evolve CPG, evolve the grocery stores, evolve products in this country or the world, because otherwise we're heading a place, we're heading straight towards that movie Idiocracy, I think. It gets brought up a lot where everything's just going to get dumbed down. Next thing you know, we're going to be watering crops with Gatorade because we forgot like how to actually grow food. And it's just going to be a ridiculous world where we're all nutrient deprived and have to, you know, rely on Big Pharma to give us our supplements or else we're all going to die. You know, it's just a ridiculous ridiculous model that we've built here.
Yeah. I do think our healthcare system and Big Pharma are even guiltier than, say, the supply chain within the food industry. Because if you had told me 40 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever, that I will feel better and I will not be needing to go to the doctors for the kind of things that people go to the doctor for if I ate the way I eat today. If you had told me that then, but who's going to tell you that? Your doctor's not, just like I told you earlier in this discussion, that the doctors were telling me, oh, you're getting older, this is all normal. You know, your cholesterol's high, you're getting older, here, we'll give you drugs. I mean, that's bad. Like, we are the unhealthiest first world country on the planet because of our food and because we use drugs instead of healthy food. And we make ourselves sick with the food that we eat. And I mean, I say these things and I think, something's very wrong here. This is like insane. And, you know, I had even heard on a podcast with these well-known doctors, plant-based doctors, who they said that the system, I don't know if it still is, but at one time, a system in Japan or China was, the healthcare system was, a doctor got paid to keep their patient healthy. They didn't get paid when their patient was sick. So you're treating a patient, you see them every year, you prescribe how they should live to stay healthy, no drugs involved, and then they get sick. And until they get healthy again, you as their doctor are not getting paid. And I'm like, yeah, that's the insurance system we should use because our insurance system incentivizes doctors to keep patients unhealthy on drugs. You know, I mean, like that doesn't make sense. So,
yeah, at least it goes back to the capitalism again, right? Because I think a lot of people working in the medical field went there because they want to help people get healthy. But the for-profit hospitals or whatever that they work for overbook them and don't give them time to really meet with patients. And it ends up becoming quicker to just run some tests and send them with a prescription on their way because you don't have time to like really help somebody along on their food and health journey. That takes time and then it takes knowing those patients, like the, I think it was probably better when there was these older system of having just a family doctor that you knew for your whole life and they knew you and they could guide you along the way. But the system is getting rigged to the point where doctors have 10 minutes with each patient and then you just got to go to each new patient. And to your point, like hospitals and drug companies don't make money off of healing people. They make money off of keeping you just sick enough that they can charge you for drugs and treatment, right? So it's an interesting model that we've put ourselves in, and I totally agree with you that it probably needs to also be evolved. If I had another life to live, maybe I would have Evolve Health podcast all about doctors and pharmacies and stuff like that.
And the other thing is that there is very few, they're just starting to get medical schools that teach nutrition, actually teach nutrition. But even at the level that they teach it, they rarely attack or talk about what's not good for you. They'll just tell you what is good for you, but they won't tell you, stay away from the potato chips. You know, it's like, just stay away from them. You know, that's not part of the curriculum yet, and it's barely part of the curriculum to X, Y, and Z. You know, nutrition, actually my son / business partner in Read the Ingredients went and got certified as a nutritionist through Stanford University. They never brought up what's bad. All he learned is how your body processes protein, macronutrients, micronutrients, you know, the balance of them. I mean, he learned a lot in great detail, but he didn't learn, don't eat this. You know, he knows not to eat this, but it wasn't part of the curriculum. Like, hello, you know, I mean, that's what if you're a nutritionist treating and consulting with clients, and he didn't go to it for that. He went to it for his own interest and for the company, but you need to be able to say the words, don't eat that. Don't eat that. Yes, we want to get you this, this, and this. But if you turn over the package of potato chips, it probably tells you you have 2 grams of protein. Oh, good. I'm getting my protein.
Yeah.
Right? Or those whole wheat crackers that are giving you fiber.
Yeah, and that's probably a whole other can of worms that we don't have time to dive into about the science of nutrition, by which I mean our bodies and the world are such complex systems that I would argue that we, even today, with the best of our science, we barely are scratching the surface of understanding how it all works together, right? So, but through our scientific methods, we need to have to be able to isolate things to be able to test them. So we can test in theory that protein does this in your body, but protein in what form and in which combination of other things and with which lifestyle and with whose genetics and so on and so forth. It's just so complex that science can't actually handle it the way we do science right now because it has to isolate things. You can't study the complexity of the system that is the human body or the earth the way that they want to. So I think that would be a whole other rant for another time, but I think that's part of the challenge and why nutrition, like what is good for you and isn't good for you according to the authorities out there and published by the government, changes all the time. It's partly lobbying by companies trying to make sure that their products are listed as healthy. I saw one study recently that said, like, I forget what it was, but some sugar cereal was listed as healthier than broccoli or something like that on the food chart because those companies paid for the studies. But so it's partly that, like, corrupt system, but then it's also just the complexity that we don't understand because, sure, in theory, this one nutrient is good for you, but it's so complex and everybody's different and it depends on so many other things that it can't be fact for everybody, right? So it's just a complex thing. That's why I always just default to, you know what, instead of having to try to understand every little nuance of nutrition and really hack my diet, why don't I just use common sense and eat the way we were evolved to eat, which is mostly plants and whole foods and not a lot of processing and in moderation and call it a day, because that's just the best method that makes the most sense based on how we were evolved to eat, right? All the other stuff, the potato chips or the superfood this and the supplement that's going to cure you overnight and so on and so forth is just all theory, right? And you just have to pay attention to your own body. If taking that supplement makes you feel better, great. That's awesome. Take that supplement. If eating this food makes you feel like crap, well, great. Now you know that's probably not meant for you. Maybe someone else can function really well on that food, but it's not for you. Like for me, I don't function as well when I eat a ton of meat, but I do know people out there with maybe it's blood type or something else that thrive off of eating a little bit more meat. Great, to each their own. You just find what works for you, and that's your diet, I think.
No, it would be wonderful if people would pay more attention to what works for them, but they don't. They do things habitually. It's the way they've always done it. That's what they've always eaten. That's what they were served as a kid. That's what makes them feel good. It's like, you know, to convince people who drink, whether they drink socially or drink addictively, you know, convince them to give that up. And it's like, no, they'd rather put up with a hangover, or they'd rather, you know, whatever, because whatever it does serve them to be drinking is a stronger pull. And the big food companies make sure that they put their stronger pull in there so that they can make more money. But anyway, yeah. One day we can solve all the world's problems.
Yeah, when the pain of not changing is more than the fear of changing or whatever, it just goes back to that, right? But anyway, so we could dive in deeper into that some other time on another episode. But for now, I know we're probably past time here, so I'll just wrap up with this one question. So I know you've changed your life by changing your eating habits. So beyond go read my book, which people should do, and we'll put links to it in the show notes, what advice do you have for others who are trying to reshape their relationship with food?
The biggest thing, and it says this in the book, the biggest thing is find out what does serve you and have that always available. So get the crap out of your house. Don't drive by. Don't put yourself in a situation where you're going to be so hungry that you have to turn into McDonald's and buy a burger. You know, keep good food with you, whether it's in your car, in your house, wherever. And that's the best start that you can do, because not succumbing to the junk food, not succumbing to the highly processed food that's really not been serving you, having the right food available at all times is the best way to get started and the best way to let your body have a chance to feel the difference. Because once you feel the difference, it's like, I can't even imagine. If you give yourself a chance to feel the difference, I can't imagine going back. I just can't.
Yeah, that's a great tip. And I think BJ Fogg is a Stanford professor who studies behavioral psychology, and he studies a lot on behaviors and change and stuff. And he wrote a book called Tiny Habits, if anyone wants to go read it. But one of the things he talks about is exactly that. It's about making it easy, right? If you have your house full of a bunch of junk food, that's going to be too easy to eat. So taking the junk food out of your house means now it takes effort to go get junk food and eat it. Whereas, like you were saying, if you fill your fridge with prepared healthy meals, so it doesn't take too much effort to eat that salad or whatever, because you've already got it in a container in the fridge ready to go. Great. Now that becomes the easy option, and you're more likely to be able to change your habit. So I think that's really good advice that at least one Stanford professor I know of will agree with. So that's a great tip. So with that said, I better let you get going. It's been a pleasure chatting with you, digging a little bit deeper into your book and your business, and hopefully sharing some of that story with other people. And I appreciate you putting in that effort to just share your journey, because I think we can all learn from each other's lives and decisions and get inspired by each other. And anywhere you can make it easier for people to do the same, the better. So I appreciate that your book does that, you know, gives helpful tips on how to make these changes, even with kind of what you just talked about, or so many other tips packed into that book. So thanks for doing what you're doing and making better for the world food, or better food for your body and a better for the world brand. I appreciate that. And thanks for coming and sharing your story on the show.
I certainly appreciate what you're doing. I really do. And I think the more of us you can get together speaking out in the world about this, the better chance we all have. But yeah, I mean, we all want the same thing. We want to help people be healthy, help the planet be healthier, and it shouldn't be so hard. So thank you, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Bobby, her book, or her company, visit rtifoods.com. Subscribe to our podcast and YouTube channel for more innovator interviews, expert advice, and leadership discussions. If you like this episode, leave a heart, thumbs up, or review, and share it with your colleagues. As an ever-evolving show, we also love feedback, so send us ideas for who we should talk to next to evolve@modernspecies.com. And of course, if you work in the industry, come join our community at community.evolvecpg.com, and we'll go further, faster together.